Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter. Pretty good Bible studies. I am now in Joshua chapter 4. I'm going to do the entire chapter, verses 1 through 24. I will call this chapter 12 Memorial Stones. Our context is this. In our last chapter, chapter 3 of Joshua, Israel is preparing to cross the Jordan, and in fact, cross the Jordan, and we take up the story here in chapter 4, verses 1 through 3. Now, when all the nation had finished crossing the Jordan, the Lord spoke to Joshua, saying, "Take for yourselves 12 men from the people, one man from each tribe, and command them, saying, Take up for yourselves 12 stones from here out of the middle of the Jordan, from the place where the priest's feet are standing firm, and carry them over with you, and lay them down in the lodging place where you will lodge tonight." Now, I didn't mention, when I talked about the context, where are the Israelites crossing from? They're still in the plains of Moab. Shittim was the place that Joshua was operating from on the east side of the Jordan River, right at the northern tip of the Dead Sea, near Mount Pisgah / Mount Nebo, where Moses had died. And so he has got the Jordan River backed up at Adam through mudslides, probably earthquakes. The water is backed up. The Israelites are crossed over, and the ark went first, and the priest, the Levitical priest, as Joshua put it, the priest, the Levites who were priests, were standing in the middle of the Jordan holding the ark, and the people passed either around them or by them onto the western side of the Jordan River, and the priests are left standing in the middle. Now, verse 2, God speaks to Joshua saying, "Take for yourselves 12 men from the people, one man from each tribe." Now, these same 12 were chosen already in the previous chapter, Joshua 3:12. Well, it doesn't say that, but we can assume that very easily, I think. Joshua 3:12, "Now then, take for yourselves 12 men from the tribes of Israel, one man for each tribe." The purpose of that was either for the leaders of each tribe to find a place for the tribe to camp when they got across the river, or it was for the purpose of setting up this memorial. If it was for the purpose of setting up this memorial, they weren't told then, but now they're told, set up this memorial pile of stones. Clark agrees with that assessment. He says, quote from Joshua 3:12, "It appears that the 12 men had been before appointed, one taken out of each of the 12 tribes, and now they are employed for that purpose for which they had been selected." Clark assumes they had been selected in for the purpose of putting these 12 stones in the memorial pile. Jameson, Fox, and Brown say here, quote, "The repetition of the command is made here solely to introduce the account of its execution. Though Joshua had been divinely instructed to erect a commemorative pile," that's back in Joshua 3, last chapter, "the representatives were not apprised of the work they were due till the time of the passage." Now, these 12 stones were taken from the middle of the Jordan River, so we can assume that the 12 men, having already crossed with their tribes, went back from the west side of the Jordan back to the middle of the Jordan River, where the priests were standing, and they were to pick up the stones and then carry them back and lay them down in the lodging place where you will lodge tonight. That's on the west side of the river. It was later called Gilgal. We see that later on in this chapter 4. We'll get there in a minute. Joshua 4:19-20. "Now the people came up from the Jordan on the 10th of the first month and camped at Gilgal on the eastern edge of Jericho. Those 12 stones which they had taken from the Jordan, Joshua set up at Gilgal." So verse 20 tells us these 12 stones that these 12 men got from the middle of the Jordan were carried back to the western side at Gilgal and were used to make a memorial pillar. We go now to Joshua 4, verses 4 through 7. "So Joshua called the 12 men whom he had appointed from the sons of Israel, one man from each tribe, and Joshua said to them, Cross again to the ark of the Lord your God into the middle of the Jordan, and each of you take up a stone on his shoulder according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Israel." I should mention here that what I just talked about in verse 3 was the Lord telling Joshua to instruct the 12 leaders of Israel to go to the middle of the Jordan to get the rocks. And now in verse 4, that command is now executed, or God's command to Joshua is executed, and then he called the 12 men. So let's start again at verse 4. "So Joshua called the 12 men whom he had appointed from the sons of Israel, one man from each tribe, and Joshua said to them, Cross again to the ark of the Lord your God into the middle of the Jordan, and each of you take a stone on his shoulder according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Israel. Let this be a sign among you, so that when your children ask later, saying, What do these stones mean to you? Then you shall say to them, Because the waters of the Jordan were cut off before the ark of the covenant of the Lord, when it crossed the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off. So these stones shall become a memorial to the sons of Israel forever." So Joshua executes the Lord's command to him. Joshua says to the 12 men, cross again. That makes it sound like the again, as John Gill says, makes it sound like the 12 men had already crossed to the western side, and then they recrossed the Jordan River to the middle, coming from the western bank. Jameson Fawcett Brown says that no, the 12 leaders held behind while their tribes went across, and then they came from the eastern bank to the middle. It doesn't really matter, but I think they came back from the western bank. So verse 6, Joshua tells the 12 leaders of Israel, let this be a sign among you. Jameson Fawcett Brown says this concerning piles of stones being used as signs. Quote, erections of cairns or huge piles of stones as monuments of remarkable incidents has been common among all people, especially in the early and rude periods of the history. And I think the reason they use stones is because stones just last forever. They just do. They are the established means of perpetuating the memory of important transactions, Jameson Fawcett and Brown continue, especially among the nomadic people of the East. Although there be no inscription engraved on them, the history and object of such simple monuments are traditionally preserved from age to age. So this was a normal thing that Joshua was doing with these stones. Joshua 4, 8 through 9. Thus the sons of Israel did as Joshua commanded, and took up 12 stones from the middle of the Jordan, just as the Lord spoke to Joshua, according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Israel, i.e. 12. And they carried them over with them to the lodging place, that's later to be named Gilgal, and put them down there. Then Joshua set up 12 stones in the middle of the Jordan at the place where the feet of the priests who carried the Ark of the Covenant were standing. And there we have a problem, because it sounds like Joshua set up 12 more stones in the middle of the Jordan River. And they are there to this day. Well, we'll talk about verse 9 when we get there in just a minute about this possibility of an extra set of 12 stones. First of all, in verse 8, the 12 leaders are said to carry the stones to the lodging place to the place later to be called Gilgal. How far is Gilgal from the Jordan River? Josephus, quoted by John Gill, says it was 6 miles from the Jordan, so we'll take Josephus' word for it. That's about how far they had to carry those stones, and that is a long way to be carrying a big rock. But not impossible. Difficult, but not impossible. Now let's go to the question, and this is not a major question, but it sounds like there were 12 additional stones put up in the middle of the Jordan, in the dry Jordan riverbed. I've always had a little bit of problem with that, because I couldn't figure out why would you set up a memorial stone in the middle of the river, because the water's going to be coming back from where it was heaped up at Adam, up the river in just a little while. Why would you put 12 stones in the middle of the Jordan River? Well, if you take the Holman Christian Standard Bible marginal reading, it turns out that there were not 12 extra stones put in the middle of the Jordan River. The Holman Christian Study Bible margin says this, now Joshua set up the 12 stones that had been in the middle. Not that he set up 12 stones in the middle, which makes it sound like another set of 12 stones, but it's 12 stones that had been in the middle. Now that had been is in brackets, which means that the translators interpolate that from the Hebrew. And so they take the position that there was only one set of stones put up in Gilgal, not one in Gilgal and one in the middle of the Jordan. Well, that just makes more sense to me, that the marginal reading takes care of it. Now, if you want to assume that there were 12 extra stones put in the middle of the Jordan, and assume that these were different stones than the 12 stones at Gilgal, here's some options as to how they were placed in the middle of the Jordan. They could be placed so that they would be totally submerged when the water came back. Totally submerged, but they could still be seen by those crossing the ford, or maybe by those walking by the side of the river. They can look and see the rocks under the water. And this is, of course, assuming the rocks could withstand the force of the current when the water is let loose from Adam upriver back downstream again. Or it could be that instead of being totally submerged under the water, that they were only partially submerged so people walking on the side of the river could see the rocks. Okay, it's possible. I still think it makes more sense that they just put 12 stones in Gilgal, none in the middle of the Jordan. Where did these rocks come from if they were to be put in the middle? From the Jordan River itself, or maybe from adjoining fields. Now, this idea that the stones came, that were, the 12 stones were referring to the stones that had been in the Jordan River and then were then placed in Gilgal, is backed up by Adam Clark, who quotes a scholar named Kennicott in his day, who says that the stones that are said to be in the middle of the Jordan in verse 9, that preposition in should be from, the stones from the middle of the Jordan. Again, that makes sense because they were taken from the middle of the Jordan back to Gilgal. I said Clark supported that, he was quoting Kennicott, who supported that. Actually, Clark disagrees with Kennicott because there are no manuscripts supporting that translation. However, I found some translations that use the term out of, the stones were out of the middle of the Jordan, which would imply that they came from the Jordan over to Gilgal in the west, and that would back up the interpretation that there's only one set of 12 stones. So translations using out of, the Peshitta Lamsa translation and Young's literal translations, the stones out of the Jordan River. There were 26 translations, on the other hand, that said that the stones were in the Jordan River. So I report, you decide. Now the stones are said to be standing there to this day. That means to the day that the book of Joshua was written. And that time is at least 20 years after the event, assuming Joshua wrote this event here. This was not done by an editor or Samuel or Ezra or somebody later. But if it was Joshua, that would probably be about 20 years after he crossed the Jordan River. We see in Joshua 24:26, and Joshua wrote these words in the book of the law of God. And he took a large stone and set it up there under the oak that was by the sanctuary of the Lord. He wrote these words in the book of the law. That's about 20 years later, Joshua 24. Of course, it would be much later if Samuel or Ezra inserted that phrase to this day into the text. We go now to Joshua 4, verses 10 through 13. The priest carrying the ark continued standing in the middle of the Jordan until everything was completed that the Lord had commanded Joshua to tell the people, in keeping with all that Moses had commanded Joshua. So here we see that God has commanded Joshua, which basically says, be strong, come across the Jordan, in keeping with all that Moses had commanded Joshua. That probably refers to Deuteronomy 31:7. Then Moses called to Joshua and said to him in the sight of all Israel. This is when Moses was still living. This is in the plains of Joab right before they're getting ready to cross over. Moses calls to Joshua and says, be strong and courageous, for you shall go with this people into the land which the Lord has sworn to their fathers to give them, and you shall give it to them as an inheritance. So in verse 10, Joshua 4, when everything was completed that the Lord had commanded Joshua to tell the people in keeping with all that Moses had commanded Joshua, in other words, when the Israelites had crossed over the Jordan River, because that's what God had commanded Joshua to tell the people, be strong and courageous when you cross the river. And Moses relayed that command over to Joshua. The people are said to hurry across in verse 10, at the end of verse 10, the people hurried across. Now here's some reasons why. The reasons are not mutually exclusive. One reason could be because they might fear that the water would come rushing back down the Jordan, which I think is a reasonable fear. You walk across a dry riverbed. John Gill suggests the reason that they wanted to hurry was they were in such a hurry to get into the promised land. Well, maybe so. Or it could be both. I think it was probably to get away from that water that's going to be coming back down shortly. Verse 11, and after everyone had finished crossing, the priest with the ark of the Lord crossed in the sight of the people. That's in sight of all the people on the west side of the bank. Because remember, all the Israelites, this is 2 million people, by the way. It's a ton of folks. They're crossed up, lined up. The tribal leaders have got them separated out, and they're watching the ark in the middle of the Jordan. And now the priests are bringing the ark back to the west side, or coming to the west side toward the people, or as Joshua says here in verse 11, in the sight of the people. Verse 12, the Reubenites, Gadites, and half the tribe of Manasseh went in battle formation in front of the Israelites, as Moses had instructed them. About 40,000 equipped for war crossed to the plains of Jericho in the Lord's presence. The plains of Jericho, of course, are the plains around Jericho, which would include Gilgal, where they're going to be camped, which is about a mile or plus away from Jericho. Now, the 40,000 troops that come by that crossed over were not from the whole 12 tribes. They were from the 2.5 tribes, the Transjordan tribes, the Reubenites, the Gadites, and half Manasseh. They are said in verse 12 to be arrayed in front of the Israelites. Now, does that show that they have precedence over the other tribes? Probably not. There's no reason to suppose that the usual order of march was deviated from. I imagine that it's broken out here, the Reubenites, Gadites, and half Manasseh, in order to emphasize the point that they're from the east, but they're still fulfilling their duties of coming over and helping the other Israelites fight the Canaanites. As Moses had instructed them, it says in the end of verse 12, when had Moses instructed them, back in Numbers 32:17 when Moses was still alive. But we ourselves will be armed, ready to go before the sons of Israel. This is the 2.5 tribes talking here. This is in Numbers 32, and about 6 verses describe the deal that these 2.5 tribes made with Moses. We like it here. We want to keep our women and children here. The pasture land is great. We don't want to go over. But if you'll let us have this land, we will go over first and fight and then come back over to the east side of the Jordan. Moses said, that's fine as long as you come fight. So just as Moses instructed, I'll read you one of those 6 verses, Numbers 32:17. But we, that's the 2.5 tribes, ourselves will be armed, ready to go before the sons of Israel until we have brought them to their place, while our little ones live in the fortified cities because of the inhabitants of the land. Now these 2.5 tribes not only had promised Moses that they would come over the land in Numbers 32:17, they'd also promised Joshua in Joshua 1:16-18. They, that's the 2.5 tribes, answered Joshua saying, all that you have commanded us, we will do, and wherever you send us, we will go. Just as we obeyed Moses in all things, so we, the 2.5 tribes, will obey you. Only may the Lord your God be with you as he was with Moses. Anyone who rebels against your command and does not obey your words and all that you command him shall be put to death. Only be strong and courageous. So the 2.5 tribes were telling Joshua to be strong and courageous. And they said, we'll obey you. So all is harmony and peace and unity as they cross the Jordan River. We go now to Joshua 4:14-18. On that day, the Lord exalted Joshua in the sight of all Israel, the day that they crossed over the Jordan River. And they revered him throughout his life as they had revered Moses. Revered Moses? Well, most of the people revered Moses most of the time, I guess. But there's a lot of stories of rebellion during that 40 years in the wilderness. A lot of rebellion. As we go through the book of Joshua, we'll see how obedient the people were. Verse 15, the Lord told Joshua, command the priest who carry the Ark of the Testimony to come up from the Jordan. The testimony, of course, is the two tables of the law. That's why it's called the Ark of the Testimony, because the two tables of the law were in the Ark. And the Ark usually went before the people. Well, it usually was carried in the middle of the people, but now it was at the front, as we saw in the last chapter. Command the priest to carry the Ark of the Testimony to come up from the Jordan. The Ark went first. They stopped in the middle of the Jordan. The people went past the Ark onto the west side of the Jordan, and now the Ark is in the middle of the Jordan. And Joshua says, come on, priest, let's come on over here to the western side. Verse 17, so Joshua commanded the priest, come up from the Jordan. When the priest carrying the Ark of the Lord's covenant came up from the middle of the Jordan, and their feet stepped out on solid ground, the waters of the Jordan resumed their course, flowing over all the banks as before. From the last chapter, we know that the Jordan River was dammed up the river at Adam, probably because of earthquakes and mudslides, and now maybe there's another shift in the earth. Maybe the mudslides have finally given way as the waters pile up behind those mudslides, pushing the Jordan River back up toward the Sea of Galilee, maybe even overflowing or filling up Galilee and overflowing its banks or overflowing the Jordan River's banks. But whatever was happening up there, it was over with and the water came back down. All of that is probably pretty natural, not supernatural, providential, but not supernatural. Now, it says in verse 18, when the priest came up from the middle of the Jordan, and when they stepped on the dry ground, then the waters came back. Now, that sounds like it happened immediately, and that's the way I read it at first. However, I can't help but notice as I think about it more closely, the text does not say that the waters came back at the precise time the priests were out of the river. It just doesn't say that. It just says when they came out. Now, that could be after they came out. You know how fuzzy those words are, when or after. Now, the pulpit commentary says, on the other hand, quote, the Hebrew text implies that the waters began to flow from the very moment that the priest's feet left the channel of the Jordan. Well, so does the English text, but I'm not so sure that's the case. But at any rate, once they got out, God in his providence let the waters come back. He wasn't going to let his ark get overflowed or his priest drowned in the river. Whether you think that's a big miracle, well, whether you think it's a natural occurrence or not, whether you think the waters of the Jordan backed up supernaturally, as one commentator I read said, or whether God used natural means to handle the rivers flowing backwards, it doesn't matter. Either way, it was a miracle. The timing of the mudslide and all was at least providential, if you don't want to call it miraculous. Now, the water came flowing over the banks as before. If you recall in the last chapter, the Jordan River had overflowed its banks at that time. This was spring, time of the barley harvest, Nisan 10. And as such, it was raining pretty hard. The snows of Mount Hermon were melting, and the Jordan River was overflowing. And in fact, that fact probably kept the Canaanites from bringing an army down there and stopping the Israelites crossing with their women and children, because they probably figured, well, the Jordan River's overflowed. There's no way they're going to cross. Well, they didn't count on the supernatural power of God to back that river up and create a dry spot for them to come over. Now, there's an application of this waters flowing back, preaching point, if you will. This is from the commentator Benson, who said that when the representatives of God, i.e. the priest, when they leave a place, judgment soon follows. Oh, that's a good point. Priests are out of the river, the water's coming back down over the spot where they were, could symbolize drowning in judgment. We go now to Joshua 4, 19 through 24, and we'll finish up this chapter. Now the people came up from the Jordan on the 10th of the first month, that's Nisan 10, and camped at Gilgal on the eastern edge of Jericho. Those 12 stones which they had taken from the Jordan, Joshua set up at Gilgal. He said to the sons of Israel, when your children ask their fathers in time to come, saying, what are these stones? Then you shall inform your children, saying, Israel crossed this Jordan on dry ground. For the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan before you until you had crossed, just as the Lord your God had done to the Red Sea, which he dried up before us until we had crossed. Notice the comparison there between what Moses had done and what Joshua had done, very similar. That all the peoples of the earth may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty, so that you may fear the Lord your God forever. Now this crossing of the Jordan on the 10th of Nisan, the first month, was 4 days before the Passover, and the Passover was kept in Gilgal. Joshua 5:10, our next chapter, we see that while the Israelites camped at Gilgal on the plains of Jericho, they kept the Passover on the evening of the 14th day of the month, Nisan 14. And as an interesting chronological note here, they crossed over on the 10th of Nisan, that is 5 days before the 40th anniversary of their exit from Egypt. Remember, that 40 years is just a round number, but it's pretty close. I mean, Nisan 10, they left Nisan 15, if you recall, Passover night. Passover was on the 14th, and they got up the next morning after the Passover lamb was sacrificed and the blood was sprinkled on the lintels and doorposts. They got up the next morning and headed out of Dodge. That was Nisan 15. And so here's Nisan 10. So, as John Gill says, 5 days before the 40th anniversary of the exit from Egypt. I've already mentioned that Gilgal has not been named Gilgal yet. It will be so named in Joshua 5:9, which says this, then the Lord said to Joshua, today I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you. So the name of that place is called Gilgal to this day. So in the next chapter, Gilgal gets named. Why is it named Gilgal? As the NIV margin says, Gilgal sounds like the Hebrew for roll. And what had happened there the next day at Gilgal, Joshua circumcised all the males who had been born in the wilderness, and that circumcision rolled the reproach of Israel away. So Gilgal rolled away the reproach of Israel because circumcision was done on that day. We'll see that in the next chapter. Where is Gilgal? I said it was 1 mile plus. Josephus says it was 10 furlongs, which is 1.25 miles from Jericho. And Josephus says it was also 1.5 miles from the Jordan River. So we're talking about short distances here, because the next stop, of course, Jericho, maybe not the next stop, but very soon Joshua wants to take over Jericho, and it's just 1.25 miles away. Now, Gilgal is an important place, as Adam Clark says in the Old Testament story. It was the place where Israelites spent their first night in the Promised Land, Nisan 10. It was the place of circumcision of all males born in the wilderness. I've already mentioned that. It was a fortified camp where Joshua constantly returned after expeditions against the Canaanites. It was probably where all women and children stayed during the whole Canaanite war. It was the place where the first king of Israel, Saul, was proclaimed king. It was the first place the manna ceased to fall. And I must say here in a previous audio, I said it probably stopped before they got into Moab. I don't know why I said that. I was going from my memory. It's apparently not so, according to Adam Clark. Of course, he could be wrong too. I haven't looked up the scripture that tells me where the manna ceased to fall. I'm sure we'll get to it eventually. Gilgal is also important because the ark stayed there until after the conquest of the whole land of Canaan. Afterwards, it was moved to Shiloh, a different place. So Gilgal is an important place to know. Look at it on the map. See where Jericho is. Gilgal is just to the south and east of it. Now, these stones, Joshua says, when your children ask, what are these stones? You're supposed to say, this is where the waters of the Jordan were held back so the Israelites could cross over. Now, this idea of teaching your children was a big deal to God. For example, when God gave the Israelites the Shema, the famous passage in Deuteronomy 6:7, "Know, Israel, that the Lord your God is one God," we see in Deuteronomy 6:7, these scriptures that were mentioned there were to be repeated to their children. "Repeat them to your children. Talk about them when you sit in your house and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up." How about the famous Passover? After the instructions for the Passover were given in Exodus 12, verse 26 and 27, we read this: "When your children ask you, what does this ritual mean to you? You are to reply, it is the Passover sacrifice to the Lord." So, ladies and gentlemen, teaching your children, it's a big, big deal to God. That's why I believe in Vacation Bible School. I believe in all those books that have all the Bible stories in them. Now, you know, I actually listened to a Reformed podcast. Listen to some Reformed Presbyterian parents talk about how they were afraid to use Christian children's books with their children because they had pictures of Jesus in there. And a picture is an image. "Thou shalt not make a graven image of the Lord your God," quoting the commandments in Exodus 20. And they said that the pictures were an image and the kids shouldn't read those things. It's just absolute stupidity, in my humble opinion. These people weren't stupid by any means, but they were preaching something that was just, to me, is just stupid. I mean, are these kids going to be bowing down to the pictures in their children's books to worship an idol? I mean, really? I don't know. That really stuck in my head when I heard that. I said, oh no, my friends, you are going too far. So teach your children, as Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young said, teach your children, teach them well. Now, these 12 stones, which we've been talking about a lot in verse 21, are mentioned again. They were probably raised on a foundation of earth and are stones, so the stones were even higher up in the air and instead of just being laid on the bare ground. Adam Clark and Jameson Foster and Brown said that if these stones were just put on the ground, they wouldn't be very conspicuous. And also, we might note that these stones can not only be an object lesson to the children of Israel, but also to their pagan neighbors, because pagans would go by and say, what are these 12 stones for? Oh, another miracle from this Yahweh God. Oh my gosh, we better not mess with him. He is the same God who brought the Israelites out of Egypt where they were slaves, and he parted the Red Sea, and now, doggone it, he's parted the Jordan River. Oh my goodness, what shall we do? Maybe we better not rely on our local pagan gods. Maybe we better bow down to this Yahweh because he's a bigger and a stronger God than all the gods that are around here. Now, verse 24 says that all the peoples of the earth may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty. Now, that's where we get the idea that the stones were not just for the children. They were for other people that would see them. But that earth there, Eretz, that probably should be translated land, that all the peoples of the land may know that the Lord is mighty, because that's who the Israelites were dealing with, the people in the land. Adam Clark agrees with me on that. All the peoples on the earth aren't going to see a memorial pile of stones in Gilgal, but the people in the land could see it. Ladies and gentlemen, we have finished with Joshua chapter 4. That prepares us to go to Joshua chapter 5 in our next audio, which I will entitle, "The New Generation is Circumcised and the First Passover in Canaan is Celebrated." I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.